Hello and welcome to the Master of Demon Gorge podcast. Today we're talking about Frontiers poetry. By the old Molmine pagoda, looking lazy at the sea, there's a Burma girl a-settin', and I know she thinks of me. For the wind is in the palm trees, and the temple bells they say, "Come you back, you British soldier, come you back to Mandalay. Come you back to Mandalay, where the old flotilla lay. Can't you hear them paddles chunkin' from Rangoon to Mandalay? On the road to Mandalay, where the flying fishes play, and the dawn comes up like thunder out of China across the bay." That was, of course, the opening stanza of Rudyard Kipling's poem Mandalay. So yes, this is going to be one of those poetry appreciation episodes that long-time listeners know we do here from time to time. And what I want to talk about today is one more subject matter where I am struck by the universality of the human experience. Vastly different cultures, separated by race, by language, by time, by geography, and by much else besides, can end up feeling substantially similar sentiments and producing comparable cultural output in the wake of comparable circumstances. In particular, today I want to talk about the circumstances of empire. Kipling, one of whose poems I quoted at the top, was famously a British imperialist poet. This was a man who, after all, coined the phrase "the white man's burden" and wrote a poem called that, praising the American colonization of the Philippines in the wake of the Spanish-American War. Jingoistic patriotism, the glories of empire, and how wonderful it is to go out and subjugate and kill barbarian races, thus form a major theme of imperial literature like Kipling's. But of course, imperial literature can be much more than that. Mandalay, for example, tells of a British foot soldier who had been posted in Burma, but was now back in London. And he recalled the sights and sounds of distant, beautiful Burma, as well as his Burmese girlfriend, whom he longed for. The poem thus paints a portrait of one corner of the British imperial periphery, as well as the British colonizers' complicated feelings toward the peoples and the lands they went out to rule. Finally, there's the sort of imperial literature that called empire itself into question. Why have it? What's it good for? And isn't it just a matter of time before it falls apart anyway? In his 1888 novella, The Man Who Would Be King, Kipling tells the story of a pair of British adventurers who enter Kafiristan, today's Nuristan in Afghanistan, and try to rule over the natives as their kings. Perhaps predictably, from our postmodern, post-colonial perspective, the adventure ends in disaster. One of the Brits is killed, the other survives torture by the locals to carry his friend's severed head and golden crown with him back to British India. But soon thereafter, shortly after relating his tale to a journalist, he loses his mind and dies as well. And in his 1897 poem, Recessional, written for Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee, Kipling wrote, "Far called our navies melt away, on dune and headland sinks the fire. Lo, our pomp of yesterday is one with Nineveh and Tyre. Judge of the nations, spare us yet, lest we forget, lest we forget." All our pomp of yesterday is with Nineveh and Tyre. Nineveh and Tyre being ancient imperial centers that had long since fallen. So, recessional was a reminder of the inevitably fleeting nature of empire. And we see the Americans then inherit that British anxiety of empire. Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, depicting Belgian imperialism in the Congo, got transmuted into the Vietnam War film Apocalypse Now, depicting American misgivings about empire, how it can drive you mad, like Colonel Kurtz. Apocalypse Now stands alongside great American Vietnam War books like The Things They Carried by Tim O'Brien. And most recently, the Iraq-Afghanistan generation of American soldier writers have given us works like Redeployment by Phil Clay and Kaboom by Matt Gallagher. What I want to talk about today is the genre of Chinese literature, specifically poetry, in particular Tang Dynasty poetry, known as Biansai Shi, Frontiers Poetry, or Poetry of the Frontier Forts. It is an imperial form of literature, so it's no surprise that it first arose during the Han Dynasty, the period in history when China first became a grand empire on a prolonged basis. Largely due to its long wars against the Xiongnu, the Han Dynasty Chinese spent a lot of time and effort defending their borderlands as well as invading and conquering foreign territories in Central Asia and what is now Mongolia. And so, of course, they wrote about it. But the genre of frontiers poetry reached its height, as Chinese poetry as a whole reached its height, during China's second great imperial age, the Tang Dynasty. In fact, fewer than 200 frontiers poems from before the Tang still survive, while the Quan Tang Shi, or complete poetry of the Tang, collects over 2,000 extant frontiers poems from that era. Again, it makes sense. The Tang Empire was even bigger than the Han, its territory in Central Asia even more extensive, so there were even more border provinces and military forts for the officials to get posted to. And the officials, as was the rule in Chinese tradition, were scholar mandarins who had devoted much of their lives to studying literature. They were precisely the class of people who liked to write poetry. Hence the enormous output in the genre of frontiers poetry. Moreover, as the Tang came in later in time, Tang poets could use the events of the Han Dynasty and the deeds of those earlier personalities as literary reference points, further providing them with imaginative fodder. We should also note that frontiers poems continued to be written in later periods as well, like the Song. But undoubtedly, it was during the Tang that the form reached its height. So, we'll focus on the Tang frontiers poems today. And, as usual, all following translations are my own, and all are devoid of any literary merit whatsoever. Like Kipling's works, some of the poems were jingoistic in tone and celebrated the glories of empire. Here is one incredibly famous poem by one of the four great frontiers poets, Wang Changling, who lived from perhaps 698 to 755 AD. 秦时明月汉时关，万里长征人未还。 但是龙城飞将在，不教胡马度阴山. The same moon as that of the Qing dynasty shines over where the Han fort once stood. The soldiers who went on that 10,000-li march have yet to return. As long as the flying general of Dragon City still lives, the barbarian cavalry shall not cross over the Ying Mountains. From the first line, you see Wang Changling referring back to Han Dynasty history. Dragon City, Longcheng, was the capital of the Xiongnu, who had been deadly enemies of the Han. In one campaign, the Han army was able to breach it. The flying general perhaps refers to the famous Han Dynasty officer Li Guang, whose nickname was the Flying General, although he wasn't the one who breached the Dragon City. That honor belonged to Wei Qing. Similarly, Jingoistic in Tongue is another Wang Changling poem. Qing Hai Chang Yun An Xue Shan, Gu Cheng Yao Wang Yu Men Guan, Huang Sha Bai Zhan Chuan Jing Jia, Bu Po Lou Lan Zhong Bu Huan. The long clouds hanging over Qinghai Lake darkens the snowy mountains beyond. The lonely fort looks longingly upon the distant Jade Gate Pass. Our soldiers in golden armors fight even 100 battles in the yellow sands, swearing never to return home until they have taken Lolan. Jade Gate, or Yumen Pass, was, of course, the westernmost extension of the Great Wall, originally built during the Han Dynasty, then rebuilt during the Tang. And Lolan was an Indo-European state that stood during the Han Dynasty in what is now Xinjiang, on the edge of Central Asia. Like I said, these poems by Wang Changling adopt an ostensibly militaristic, jingoistic tone. They seem to celebrate empire. But it also seems to me that by recalling the Han Dynasty when writing during the Tang Dynasty, Wang Changling was also reminding us of the impermanence of empire. Didn't the Han dominion over these areas ultimately collapse? Was not collapse also the ultimate fate of the Tang dominion? Some poems focus more on painting a picture of the scenery or life on the frontiers. Here's one by the poet Wang Zhihuan, who lived from 688 to 742.
黄河远上白云间，一片孤城万仞山。 羌笛何须怨杨柳，春风不度玉门关.
The yellow river flows down as though out of the clouds. The fortress stands alone amidst the mountains. The barbarian flute sounds like it's complaining that the willows won't sprout. But why? You know the spring breeze cannot reach beyond the Jade Gate Pass. Some poems depict the lives of the soldiers guarding the frontiers in a fairly neutral way, like this poem by Lu Lun, 743 or 44 to 800.
月黑雁飞高，单于夜遁逃，欲将轻骑逐，大雪满弓刀.
On a black, moonless night, the geese fly high overhead. In the darkness, the Chan Yu escapes. We wish to pursue him with light cavalry, but the blizzard has covered our bows and broadswords with snow. That's another need-to-know term, by the way, in reading Frontiers poetry. Chan Yu was the title of a Xiongnu chieftain, like the later title Khan. Edward Gibbon rendered the term in Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire as Tanju, but it is the same as Chan Yu, as reported by the Chinese. Of course, just like with Kipling's poetry and with films like Apocalypse Now, the futility of empire and war eventually comes through these poems. One incredibly famous poem by Wang Han, born in 680, goes as follows.
葡萄美酒夜光杯,
欲饮琵琶马上催。醉卧沙场君莫笑，古来征战几人回。Tasty wine in a jade, glow in a dark glass. I'm about to drink when the pipa sounds, calling us to ride into battle. If I fall down drunk on the battlefield, sir, please don't laugh. Because since time immemorial, how many men get to return from war anyway?The Chinese-American sci-fi fantasy writer Ken Liu included this poem, translated, of course, in one of his short stories, put into the mouth of one of his characters. So you may say that this poem has by now entered American literature. But it was Du Fu, 712 to 770, that wintry, melancholy conscience of Chinese poetry,who gave us one of the frankest and most direct statements on the immorality of empire. 挽弓当挽强，用箭当用长，射人先射马，擒贼先擒王。杀人亦有限，列国自有疆。苟能制青陵，岂在多杀伤。 If you're going to draw a bow, draw a strong one.If you're going to use arrows, use long ones. If you wish to shoot a man, shoot his horse first. If you wish to capture the enemy, capture his king first. But there's a limit to how many people you can kill, and every country has rightful borders. Surely our goal is to prevent attacks against our own, not to kill and maim as many as possible. The third and fourth lines of this poem,If you wish to shoot a man, shoot his horse first. If you wish to capture the enemy, capture his king first. Have since become proverbial in Chinese, well known to all, even those who don't know this poem. One critic deemed these lines the most economical phrasing of a principle of strategy and leadership. But the poem as a whole is obviously a protest against the cost in human lives.That imperial wars necessarily entail. Before we end, I want to circle back to English poetry. One poem in particular that also highlights the impermanence of empire. Specifically, because it talks about an antique land. The antique land that the poet had in mind was Egypt, but ancient China was nearly as antique.And the poem talks about coming upon the broken statue of an ancient pharaoh, now a monument to his long-lost empire. It seems to me that the frontiers poetry of the Tang Dynasty serve also as monuments to the fallen empire of the Tang, that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, to quote Tennyson.But precisely because they exist in abstract form, as poems and rhymes, as words on the tongues of men and women, and aesthetics in their hearts, I would argue that they actually achieve a greater permanence, something closer to immortality, than monuments made of stone. This is Ozymandias by Percy Shelley.I met a traveler from an antique land, who said, Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert, near them on the sand. Half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things.The hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal, these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare. The lone and level sands stretch far away.This has been MODG. Thank you for listening.